Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Go. Bloop. Bloop, bloop. I don't think we've done that on pod. I think we've only ever done that on last call.
I think we've done it every time on pod.
No.
The
remember I edit these things.
The boo-boop hasn't made it.
Is this, it's not.
Will this be the one where the boo-boop makes it in?
Yeah, definitely. That's the fun that you can see on last call. I was going, boo-boop, Allah had a heart. Oh my God.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour. I'm Tommy.
And I'm Jimmy. That felt very... And this is the only musical theater podcast with maraschino cherries.
And what's new, Buenos Aires.
That is the best one we've ever done, and I won't have anyone say any different.
Here, we take apart your favorite shows, muddle them together with a shot of buffoonery, and pour you a refreshing glass of musical theater conversation. Jimmy, what are you drinking today?
Well, sir, I am drinking some great, maybe like an ambrosia milkshake. That would make sense. Do you know that reference? Because there's no liquids in this show, I don't think.
There are no liquids in the show. I don't know that reference. And an ambrosia milkshake sounds gross.
So there's two things about that. One, ambrosia is the food of the gods.
Yes, obviously.
It was what was in the cornucopia. Gods. Two, ambrosia is the brand, like it's a big brand of like our custards.
Okay.
And like rice puddings.
Okay.
So actually, an ambrosia milkshake would be bloody good.
Yes.
So that's all I have to say on that.
Why? Well, tell me in the form of a quiz question.
Acquaintment, thank you very much, sir. Well, this is a good one.
Is it?
No. And actually, since then, I've found like three other questions that would have been much better. But do you know what? It was a bit of a game this time, guys. Bit of fun.
Did you have fun?
So much fun, actually. Okay, this musical has at least three things in common with Singing in the Rain.
I wonder, I can't even remember what the three things were that we thought about. Okay, they were Gene Kelly.
It was a movie to musical adaptation.
Oh, that's a stupid one.
That's very perfectly valid.
That's fair. But it was a movie musical before it ever was a stage musical.
Yes. Uh-huh. And the third one, can you remember? At one brief point, they sing and dance in the rain. So there you go.
We must have been real tired at the end of Oliver.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
There's actually so many better quiz questions that we could have done.
Throw one in now. What was the better question?
There was one that was like, because the original source material for Xanadu was actually like this random...
Film.
That was also an adaptation of a play. So, like, this musical is an adaptation of a film, which is an adaptation of a play, which is a, you know what I mean? Like, that kind of thing.
That would have been a better question. Kind of yeah. Anyway, it's Xanadu. Here we go.
It's fucking Xanadu. To get that though, to be honest though, you just need to think, okay, Gene Kelly, what else has he done?
Yeah, we have smart listeners who'd understand our bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way people will get that because there's probably many other things that have way more things in common, but it doesn't matter. It's a bit of fun, guys, okay? Anyway, Xanadu has music and lyrics by a lot of people, but primarily Jeff Lynne of the Electric Light Orchestra fame, mm-hmm. And John Farrar of Grease fame. Yes,
indeed. And greasy it has fame. Book by Jimmy's favorite, Douglas Carter Bean. Bean? Beanie?
Bean. Big Bean Man.
Bean.
What a man. What a man.
This musical opened in 2007 on Broadway. And it had, I think, more success than I would have expected it to have.
I think more success than I think the producers probably expected it to have, which is great.
Yeah,
it did pretty well. It got nominated for a number of things, critically quite well received. And a really solid run.
Yeah, a successful national tour afterwards. A canceled. Did you read about the 2019 canceled tour? Very disappointing.
Yeah, I know. Actually, that would have been bloody good.
Would have been great. And did you see who was going to play the evil sisters?
Yes. And it's like a thing that should have happened on Broadway. Well, obviously, it's not Broadway. It's a tour.
Right.
But should have happened a long, long time ago. So it was Ginger Minj and Jinx Monsoon.
Yeah.
Two of our best musical theater drag exports.
It would have been fantastic.
Great.
But yeah, based on the movie Xanadu, the poorly received movie with Olivia Newton-John and Gene Kelly, Gene Kelly's last movie.
I know.
Oh. I think it is delightful because
we're going to talk, aren't we? I feel like we just talk now, don't we? We just have to. Okay. Listen.
This movie's nuts.
It's absolutely nuts. But who the hell hates this?
I mean, for its...
Heterosexuals? Like, who is it?
I did watch... Because I like... Do you ever watch, like, old trailers for old movies? I enjoy it to see how, like, the art of making a trailer has changed.
I do, yes. And actually, this was still in the time of, like, glorious trailers.
Yes. If, like...
Olivia Newton-John!
And I think they call it like the all musical show, and it's like, is it though?
It's really not.
This show, I mean, you can tell a lot of it got left on the cutting room floor, and that there was some. I don't know if anyone was ever driving this movie.
Well, no. So apparently, literally, no one was driving this movie. I think there was like 8 iterations of the script before it even got optioned.
Yeah,
and like. I think even then, they still hadn't signed off on a script by the time that they had started shooting. So that tells you everything you need to know. And I kind of love that. That's what an adventure they would go on.
Shooting from the hip. It certainly doesn't seem like anyone, you know, at least from the bits and pieces I had said, you would imagine that a show like that would have a very tumultuous on-set feeling. But the sense I get is that people had fun making this thing.
I think so. Like, I think it's weird because, like, a lot of people don't talk about it well because in light of the reviews. But any, like, clips and things that you see of people in the midst...
Yeah.
They're really upbeat about it.
Yeah.
I think they know that, like, they don't know where it's going and they know that it's wild, right? But you can tell that they're having a lovely time.
It's interesting to watch. It certainly, I will admit, there were 2 moments in watching the movie where I did fall asleep and have to rewind.
Really?
Yeah, actually.
Because you were particularly tired or because you got bored?
I think because I just got bored and disengaged.
What bits?
The first time I fell asleep and then woke up in the middle of the animated sequence. I was like, oh, great. Shit, I missed something. And then the second time...
You actually didn't.
Right? I rewound and was like, how did... Oh, okay. Like, maybe I just closed my eyes for a little too long.
Right.
And then I did find myself disengaging during the very long... Oh, what's the number? Where Gene Kelly and What's-His-Face are both in the... their imagined... I thought it was cool... But it just kept happening.
Oh, no, I was totally into it. It was very Broadway.
Yes.
Everybody knows.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Interesting bits. I wouldn't have thought that they would. I would have probably fallen asleep at like the bit when they dance around the like soundstage. Whatever that duet was.
Yeah, that one was weird.
Just Not even because it was dark, just because it was a nice lilty song.
Yeah. Like when the palm trees inflate and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. When they that sing and dance in the rain.
I think that's you know, the bad parts about this movie are like none of it makes any sense. Like,
no.
It doesn't, you know, and then they all go shopping for clothes, I think.
Because it's important to look glitzy.
Is that why we had a whole dance number with clothes?
Yes,
they didn't wear any of the clothes that they got.
Yes, they did.
Did they?
Gene Kelly comes up to, I can't remember his name. What's his name?
Sonny.
The beautiful one. Michael Beck.
Yeah.
Yes, Sonny. Comes up to Sonny when he's sat on the beach and is all depressed because Kira's left. And he's like, look at me. I'm snazzy. He's got a necktie on.
Oh, okay.
So they... Come on, this is a deep story here that has lots of clear, clear thought, so I won't hear it.
Well, and even I was reading that, like, perhaps one of the key plot points got entirely excised from the script, that
yes.
The mural with the muses on it was painted by Sonny.
Right.
Was, like, so, an initial plot point that is not in the movie.
It doesn't feature whatsoever. I think at one very brief point, he says... I painted a mural. Do you know, just at one point in his life, I painted it, and that's about it. But I thought that was, come on, that's implied.
But so much of this movie is implied then.
Implied, yeah, exactly.
Like, that's the other thing.
Maybe I've just been watching too much David Lynch, and I'm just, you know, I'm so used to things not having any narrative sense. I'm just like, of course.
But, like,
of course.
Can you imagine seeing this for the first time? Like, even going in, I had a sense of some of the wackiness of it, but, like, they hold on to for the longest time that she's a muse and a god. And then he roller skates into the wall and ends up in Tron. And
he ends up in bloody Tron, yeah.
And we never... Do they even say that it is Zeus and...
No.
So,
it's not even credited. It's credited as, like, old man and old woman or something like that.
It's such, like... I think people watched 2001 A Space Odyssey and were like, okay, so it doesn't need to make sense. And then ran with that.
I think maybe that's it. Yes, yes. So, right, to jump onto your point there, where you said people would have an idea of just how zany this was.
Yeah.
So, hands up, I had never encountered anything to do with Xanadu other than the song Xanadu at all prior to researching for this show.
Yeah.
So I had no idea. I thought it was, like, I thought it was set on Mount Olympus. Like, I thought it was about... like gods,
yeah,
and they just like got the name wrong and called it Xanadu. Do you know what I mean? And I thought it was quite a popular film, so I had no idea about the hate, which shows that I've been mixing in good circles that, you know, people appreciate the film. But as I was watching, I was like, oh my god, I sent you a message. I was like, why the hell have I not
why
seen
have you never...
this before?
It does seem right up your alley.
It's so my alley, it's everything that my alley is. Like, I can't wait to watch it again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Can you put into words, what do you enjoy about this movie? I will never watch this movie again.
Really?
Yeah.
How dull your life will be, sir. it was just so fun. It was lovely. Like, it was absolutely lovely. And the dance numbers were great.
The dance numbers are fantastic, yes.
I love the music.
Sure.
Like, and... you know, Michael Beck can't act for toffee, but he's really pretty. I'll take it. Do you know what I mean? If I can't have one, I'll have the other. Thank you. Do you know what I mean? Like, Jane, I was kind of watching it. I was like, I totally appreciate that this is trash, but it's so good. Like,
yeah,
it's just like good trash.
Yeah, that's fair. I also enjoyed it. Like, you know, don't get me
like,
wrong.
Like, can you not see yourself... like, you've had a rough week.
Uh-huh.
You've had a really rough week.
Yeah.
Your boyfriend's just brought in a lovely pack of edibles. And you're like, do you know what we should do right now? We should put on Xanadu.
Yeah, you know, that actually sounds very nice.
yeah, like, describe your perfect Saturday afternoon. But I think like, that is exactly what it should... And I'm kind of like, God, I wish I knew about this film when I was in the depths of my anxiety last year. Like,
sure.
You know what I mean? This would be such a great remedy of, like... pure unadulterated escapism. There's no peril at any point.
No.
whatsoever in the film.
No.
I mean, it is just out and out joy.
Yeah.
Right? What I will say, though, not a musical.
Certainly not a musical. It was advertised as being one. And, I mean,
it has a soundtrack and Olivia Newton-John sings a couple of songs.
Yeah. I guess Gene Kelly sings diegetically once.
Yes.
Does anyone else? Because Olivia Newton-John doesn't really like sing on screen that much.
No, she does. She sings twice on screen. I think she sings in Xanadu, and then there's that other one. And then I guess there's a duet. Maybe it is a musical. It doesn't feel like a musical.
It doesn't feel like a musical. But I don't know.
None of these songs are meant to be in this. Do you know what I mean? The score, like nothing is written in as part of this book.
Right.
Testament to the fact that. So I read a Rolling Stone article with Jeff Lynne from ELO.
Okay.
And he briefly talks about it. And he was like, I mean, I've never seen it. No, people said it was awful. So I just thought, what's the point? but the songs that I wrote are really good for it. And I was like, okay, cool. So you had a lot of involvement, a lot of engagement with the film process. And I think that kind of shows you, you know,
what the investment was in this thing.
Exactly. If he has no idea what is going on in the film.
Yeah.
Then these songs are not meant to be there. Do you know what I mean?
But are they, like, man, it's such a strange melding of the pop music world and the film world and the musical theater world. Like, would these songs have charted as high were they not associated with a film, even though the film is shit? Like, if the album just came out on its own...
It might have, though, because of Olivia Newton-John and because of ELO. Yeah. You know, I think, I think that is probably why they did so well. I actually think the movie probably hindered.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which is a big old shame. I think, I don't know. Because, so, if you don't know, I mean, first of all, if you haven't seen the film, please, actually, I would say go and watch it. It's only an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it's an experience, and it's if you're listening to this podcast, it's worth knowing for the context of the podcast, but also the actual soundtrack of the film was hugely successful.
Yeah,
far outdid the success of the film,
and I'm sure owes to the success of the stage musical that we're going to talk about in a second.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it definitely has a lot of credo.
Yeah.
And a lot of good names attached to it, because, you know, if you think like John Farrar, who'd just done Grease, and wrote like a lot of Olivia Newton-John's pop songs as a singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. Cliff Richard also got involved, which I find crazy.
Yeah.
Do you know who he is?
His name seems familiar.
Because he's very British, but I think he's probably enjoyed some success across the pond. He's a weird man, Tommy.
Huh. What has he written that I would recognize?
You might know Livin' Doll. I feel like that was one of his bigger ones. Got myself a crying, talking, sleeping, walking, living doll.
I do not recognize that.
Got to do
that.
My best to please it. What else might he have done that you would know? Did he do Summer Holiday?
Yes.
I think he might have done Summer Holiday,
yes, he did. According to the Wikipedia article I'm reading about him right now.
Oh, okay. You know that song? We're all going on a summer holiday.
No, I think these are all things you've invented.
Fair enough. I did not invent Cliff Richard. I take no responsibility for that man. That's a surprise, actually. You don't have any Cliff Richard. Anyway, to the British people, wow, Cliff Richard wrote on this.
But yeah, huge names attached to it, a surprisingly large budget. It does seem like it ballooned in production. To become even bigger than initially intended.
Yeah, I think that's another kind of thing. It's like it probably started out as this kind of like indie,
like campy
film. Anyway, yeah, exactly. Like they were just like, we want to make this silly film, and then suddenly it's like, well, here's Gene Kelly.
Right.
So, I do want to, before we move away from the music of the film though. What ELO?
Yeah, I know.
You know ELO?
Yes. What's the one?
Mr. Blue Sky.
Mr. Blue Skies. That's the one.
Yeah.
Real popular pre-assembly song, although you have to end it before the second bit that everyone forgets about, where it gets all weird.
The Mr. Blue Sky.
There's like a weird dubstep drop in the middle of Mr. Blue Sky that I love, but that everyone forgets exists.
Fair. So, well, that's good to know that you know Yellow, though.
Yeah.
Because they're great.
They are great. They wrote great music for this movie, even though it doesn't really...
Exactly.
Like, the thing
well,
is...
Well, I was quite surprised, because I was like, oh, surely Yellow have done a musical.
Yeah, and they haven't. Is
they
this
haven't.
As close as they've gotten.
And this is as close as it gets. And I was like, wow.
That's fascinating.
That is a surprise, because their music is so theatrical.
Yeah. I am amazed at how unapplicable all the songs are to this movie. Like, even...
Oh, completely.
In context, they still don't... Like, it just... And here's a song, like...
Yeah, insert love song.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Insert sad song.
Yeah.
Like, that's... There's nothing... Like, there's not even, like, mention of gods.
No, there's no mention of the, like, Greek mythology understory. Not that there's much of an understory to talk about, but there's right. also no mention of what's-his-face's, like, art career.
Yeah,
just, like,
nothing.
The big, big themes of the thing don't make it into the music.
Exactly. And that's something... So there's some really, like, hardcore Jeff Lynne fans out there, and I wonder if any of them listen to her podcast. Because I would like to know, like... Because I've not been able to find anyone talking about this. Like, where did this come from?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, was it, we want to write this show, we love ELO's music, Jeff Lynne, will you write some songs?
Right.
Like, is that, that's how I can see it working?
Yeah.
Rather than, like, we want this musical, this is what we want, you know what I mean? Like, here's our plan.
Right.
And Jeff Lynne from ELO, we want you to be a part of it, and he somehow just failed. Like, I don't think that's what happened.
No.
Like, I think he was just charged with writing 5 songs.
Yeah.
And did it? I don't know.
And also, when they were like, we really want to do a roller skating film, but, like, it takes a long time for important plot points to need us to be on roller skates.
Yes.
They just kind
of
roller skate as a matter of course. Like, it's not, like...
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, like, obviously the setting is Venice Beach.
Right.
Which is, like, roller skating.
So we can be roller skating. But
but that's about...
That's about it.
You know what I mean?
Like, when they're roller skating around the soundstage, they don't need to be... They could be dancing.
They really don't.
You know? And like, at the very least, in the... And we'll get to the stage adaptation. But at least it is more implied early on that they want to open... They call it a theater in that one, not a club. But, like... Mm. All implications are that Gene Kelly and Sonny want to open a music club akin to
right.
Gene Kelly's big band days.
Right, exactly. And, like, I mean, there's a whole number about that, a whole
yeah.
incredible number, may I add. Let's pause for a second and we'll talk about dancing. Is it one of my favorite mashups that's ever been written? Tommy!
It's very conceptual. It's very cool. That moment where the two bandstands, like, accordion merge into each other is a visual masterpiece.
But along with the music.
Yeah.
I was like, that is some stage and screen goodness right there.
It's very cool. And it has, I guess, of all the big songs, has more to do with the story than many other songs.
In a metaphorical,
yes, thematic way, we are seeing Sonny and What's-His-Face's worlds combining.
Uh-huh.
And they're like combined muse existing together.
Yes, exactly. And it's I quite like that as like a theme of the whole piece.
Yeah.
This like remembering the past but looking forward to the future. And I was like, that's a nice idea, isn't
it's a,
it?
It's a neat theme. I wish they did more with it.
I wish that was a part of the story, yes, rather than just at one point. But no, like, that is really, that's a very well-written song, because I actually wasn't expecting it.
Yeah.
Because normally you can sometimes, we've talked about this before, when there's like point counterpoint numbers, like right. in The Music Man,
yeah,
like you're leaving too big a gap there.
Right.
We know something's
got to fit in there later. Yeah.
Right. But then here I was not expecting a counterpoint moment whatsoever.
No.
These were two extremely different sounds suddenly merging together in like a really cool,
way. In a way that I can't. You know, when else has rock and roll and big band, I don't even know whether to classify the modern thing as, it's rock and roll, disco funk.
Well, yeah, I mean, that guy with the synthesizer,
yeah,
he was living.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? He was really having a great time tying up that woman to his speaker. Remember that? It was great. Yeah, it's not rock and roll, you know, it's not
right,
60s rock and roll.
Right.
It's the kind of pre-punk,
yeah,
whatever that was. I guess in the ELO kind of,
in that kind,
you know, Queen,
yeah.
ELO, that kind of way. But yeah, that was part and parcel where I was like, this is incredible.
It's probably the best part of the movie. I think it's better than Xanadu, the closing number, which more people know.
I would agree. Yeah, I think like the closing number, yeah, it's good. It's good fun. The song's lovely, but we don't need the cowboy breakdown.
Right. When it does also feel, it's not. I
just realized what I said. Out of context. What the hell?
I knew exactly what you meant.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it doesn't quite, you know, it's supposed to be this huge celebratory moment, which it is, but it's also very much choreographed and for the camera. And we haven't had this background of youngsters that have been looking for a hip new spot to go to the entire
right.
movie, that we get the satisfaction of like, oh, and now they love each other all together at once.
Right, exactly.
And also combined with this poorly telegraphed plot of maybe a different Olivia Newton-John, who's now not the muse, but maybe...
Well, the magic waitress Olivia Newton-John.
Right.
Yeah, that was a strange...
Yeah, and like, we get it, happily ever after, but like...
But also like... They kind of gave him the free pass when, like, the woman was like, maybe for a moment.
Right.
Maybe forever.
They should have just...
They could have just done it forever.
Just done that. Why not? Yeah. No.
Then cancel it out with random waitress. But, hey, why not? Xanadu, eh? Yeah, I think... I agree. I think that dancing number is better. But, actually, the dressing room shop montage number...
Bonkers.
It was out of this world. Like, I kept clutching my face because I just couldn't believe what I was watching.
It was so fast, my brain couldn't process it.
Yes, yes, very much that.
Like, and,
like, people just kept appearing.
Yeah, and there was cool stuff happening, but my brain wasn't, like, well set up to, like, go as fast as the movie was going.
Right.
It was like.
Have
you ever had a ViewMaster? You know, the red things where
yes.
you click through.
Ching,
it was like the ViewMaster, but someone else was clicking the thing too quickly for you.
Yes, and you weren't being able to focus in time. Yes, absolutely that. Because sometimes Gene Kelly was there and dancing, and he was dancing in a 1940s,
yeah.
you know, ballroom style. And suddenly, then there's a woman with punk hair, and I'm like, ah,
yeah.
But also like, ah,
and also we
like
we entered the scene with like. These mannequins that aren't mannequins that then came to life that invited them in.
And we're fine with that. We'll move, you know what I mean? Like, we'll keep going.
Right. And the big fake pink car. And why was it a fake pink car?
Oh, I can't remember the big fake pink car.
They, like, push out this fake, like, Rolls Royce pink car, but it looks like it was made for, like, a very good high school production of this show.
Right. And, oh, yes.
And then Gene Kelly gets out of it.
I remember that.
But it's just in the store.
Why not? What was that store?
What was that store selling?
And he got that wee snazzy scarf, so good on him. You know what I mean? What a thing. Right? But I think that's I can see, because I imagine people are going to be like, what the hell are they talking about? All of their reputation is gone. Like, In the canon of musical theater, I'm not putting Xanadu up there.
No.
Okay? In no way, shape, or form. As in the film. I'm not putting the film up there. But as an experience, as a film on its own.
Yeah, worth a watch. It's fun.
So delightful.
It's fun in the same way that watching Fantasia is fun.
Go on.
Like, Fantasia is like pretty lights and music to go along with it.
And the, right, okay, but you don't care about the music.
And you don't care too much about the music, and the story is, if there is one, is generally relatively inconsequential.
Mm.
But it's
there's a hippo and a crocodile, and do we care?
It's real fun to look at.
Yes, I'll give you that. And also, there's some Greek
and also there's
themes.
Some Greek underscoring themes. I mean, I do wonder if there is something
huge.
Deeper about, I don't know, this is probably a whole other thesis on its own, but like...
About Xanadu?
Whatever our like childlike entertainment cortex is, you know, the same reason like kids like to, you know, hit at the mobile above their crib or really enjoy watching something like the Teletubbies. Like pretty lights, funny noises, you know, interesting to look at. And Xanadu tickles the same part of your brain. It feels like
100. It is. It's that kind of like assault to the senses that's really enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I fully would agree with that.
And you're not like processing meaning per se.
No, and I think that's where a lot of people fall down, is that they're trying to.
Right.
Obviously watching a lot of David Lynch, like people just need to take like for like and just think, this is what it is. I don't need to try and find this, like, why.
Right.
You don't need to ask why to everything. Just
well,
enjoy, just sit
the
back.
The thing with Xanadu, though, is, like, all signs point to that this was supposed to be a movie with a plot and music,
yeah.
And it just wasn't. Like, they didn't intend this fantastical art house, you know.
Fantasia.
Yeah. Like, that was not written at the top of the chalkboard on day one in the writer's room.
Okay, I'll give you that. Yeah, no, I really, as a big David Lynch fan, I should stop comparing that to David Lynch films. That's quite important. Before we move on, though,
mm-hmm.
I do want to talk a little bit about Gene Kelly.
Yeah, he's great.
Because he is our kind of musical theater grounding here. Very great.
He's so good.
Like, surprisingly great.
Yeah, like, I genuinely laughed at... they don't make rocks like they used to.
Right.
And, like, there's a couple points where he does that, like, Gene Kelly cross-eyed goofy face. You know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, when he's playing with his face.
Yeah!
Randomly.
Such a, like, wholesome moment in Gene Kelly, who still sits in my brain in this kind of asshole-esque
yeah, absolutely.
View of him.
Absolutely. But I think, like, weirdly, watching this and seeing him... I think sincerely having a good time.
Yes.
Right? Like, he's a good actor. He's not that good an actor.
No, he's a better
you know
dancer
what I mean?
Than he is an actor.
Right. And I think you would be able to see if he was phoning it in.
Right.
He wasn't really having a nice old time.
Well, and we've entered, certainly the time of MGM movie musicals spans mm-hmm. several decades, but I do think Xanadu is squarely out of that kind of golden movie,
absolutely.
Golden age MGM stuff, where there's a lot of, you know, put Gene Kelly in a movie and he's got like 16 default facial expressions he can use that'll probably get him
yeah.
through it. And say that
yeah.
for everyone from that era. I don't mean it as a slight.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this movie is from a different cinematic time period.
Totally.
And it does, he comes across as super earnest. You're right.
It's quite refreshing.
Yeah.
There's a few, like, behind the scenes facts that I know about him
mm-hmm.
From this film. Number one, which I absolutely love. So the how they got him on, mm-hmm. obviously they wanted Gene Kelly. And I think it was Kenny Ortega that really, really pushed for him.
Yeah.
Initially he like point blank refused to do any dancing.
Hmm.
Then he went in for a meeting with Kenny Ortega,
mm-hmm.
Just the two of them. And he was like, I'm not dancing. But if I was going to dance, what kind of dance would I be doing? And Kenny Ortega was like, well, I would imagine it would be, you know, pulling from your own mm-hmm. lexicon.
Yeah.
And he was like, what do you mean, what kind of thing? And so Kenny Ortega kind of got up and did some of like the Gene Kelly classics.
Uh-huh.
And apparently Gene Kelly was naming, like just naming them. They'd be like, that's the, you know, that's the that,
uh-huh.
that's that.
Uh-huh.
And then got up and they kind of started riffing together, uh-huh. like in dance. I think it eventually like came up with almost like a kind of routine. We worked up a bit of a sweat and Gene Kelly was like, all right, I'm going to do it.
Huh.
And that was how he kind of did. And then from that point on,
yeah.
Gene Kelly actually kind of took Kenny Ortega under his wing and became a sort of mentor for him for like the next 20 years of his life. And like, this is still relatively early in Kenny Ortega's career.
Absolutely.
And I think, wow, that's a gift. Like,
yeah.
Because say what you want about Gene Kelly, but the man can dance and the man can choreograph.
Yeah, well, like, and he has an understanding of cinematic choreography.
Exactly.
He understands dance for film, which Kenny Ortega, that's his specialty these days, right?
That is his specialty, and he is a bit of a master of it.
Yeah.
So I thought that little yarn was delightful. So he choreographed the Whenever You're Away From Me mm-hmm. number mm-hmm. with him and Olivia Newton-John. So this was filmed as like pickups. This was filmed after production had finished.
Yeah.
And they got him back on, and he initially kind of refused because like, no, my contract's up. I'm not doing this. They eventually got him back on the grounds of it would be in a closed sound stage,
mm-hmm.
and the only people there would be him, Olivia Newton-John, the camera operator, and Kenny Ortega, and that was it.
That's so... I'm not a Gene Kelly historian. I wonder if you know. Why is Gene Kelly so nervous about dancing later in his career?
I think it's because the classic thing of anyone being nervous about doing things... he had a big break, do you know what I mean? There was a chunk of time when he wasn't dancing. And obviously, as an older gentleman,
you
can't be as spry as you were, you know what I mean? When in your Singing in the Rain glory days. Like, but what I will say to his credit... The man's still pretty damn spry.
Oh, he's got it. It's really sweet. I find it really wholesome. And the fact that his character's whole underscore, his sentimental story is like, I used to do art, but I don't anymore.
Exactly. Like the good old days. And, it's nice for a time. And you can see, I think, like, there is a lot of genuine, earnestness in his performance there. And I think him and Olivia and John are a lovely little pair
mm-hmm.
because obviously she's no Debbie Reynolds, who was still relatively new,
mm-hmm.
But she was a dancer. Olivia and John, not a dancer.
Yeah.
And he said before in interviews that he choreographs pieces for the women that he's working with.
Sure.
So in theory, Debbie Reynolds got a harder time
mm-hmm.
because she was good and he knew that she could be
mm-hmm.
great. Whereas with Olivia Newton-John,
right?
Because you can tell, it's not,
it's not,
it's lovely,
it's fine,
but it's very sweet. And you can tell she's not gone through the same, extreme torture that Debbie Reynolds went through in Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
But it's still a really nice number, I think, like, so a really nice piece, and apparently they both got on really, really well.
Yeah. Huh.
Which I quite like. I think that's lovely.
It's such a fascinating, like, passing of, you know, a tiny passing of a torch that seems to have existed inside of Xanadu. And does kind of mark a, you know, we're in that time of, what are we, 1980 even?
Mm-hmm. I think.
So, like, we're just coming off Hair, the movie, Grease is 2 years ago, The Wiz is a couple years ago, I think they're the late 70s. We're seeing this transition of movie musicals from, like, this is where we're ending. We're leaving that kind of soundstage, MGM-y, Comden and Green style, Freed Unit stuff. And now moving into the like 80s, 90s of musical theater, which is wacky.
Yeah.
and
it is.
Has a very like hippie homegrown feel to it.
And a very much a like high experimental feel, because obviously there's lots of weird graphics and visual effects decisions that they make in this film.
Just even all the funky transitions where like something will end and then it'll be like,
I'm obsessed with the transitions. They're great. Or just like massive X.
Yeah.
For no reason.
It feels like straight out of Sesame Street. I mean, I guess this is why I feel like it is that Teletubby tickling of your brain.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, then Elmo shows up and is like, ha ha, next scene. Like,
exactly. That's the thing is, I'm like, what I would love to know, to be that fly on the wall, to be like, was that a creative decision? Or were they just like, fuck it. Let's just do a big joke. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Because like, it feels like, it does feel like those kind of late 70s.
Yeah.
TV shows like Laverne and Shirley,
yep.
Not Laverne and Shirley, Cagney and Lacey, mm-hmm. very different. Like, I don't know why, it just calls into those,
yeah.
like Charlie's Angels, do you know what I mean? Like that very late 70s
yeah,
vibe.
And I'm sure it's just of the time. And it was, because I remember first clocking the transitions after like the seventh one happened. And then there was some scene that just ended with like fade to black, fade back up. And I was like, oh, what's going on? Like,
exactly. They were just, they forgot to put in a transition there, I guess.
Or were they
the wrong one?
Or were they making a story choice, whatever possible story choice you could make at that moment?
I hope so. Don Bluth.
I know.
Isn't it?
Not to mention like, the whole like rotoscoped dancing segment. Like, all the weird special effects, the weird smeary yellow,
lightning speed work.
Speed trails, and the whole, like, weird blue outline. I don't know if it was rotoscope or whatever.
Well, I think it must have been rotoscoping, but also, they composited that piece of film 9 times. That's advanced shit.
There's some neat SFX stuff in here. And you can see when...
for one number? For your opening? Like, come on.
When Sonny ends up in, like, the Negaspace, and you can tell he's blue screen because he's got blue fringe, but they put him on a black background.
Yeah. And then there's, like, little bits of his fringe that aren't attached. Yeah. I love that.
It's a nutso film on a, like, production styling and special effects styling, but no one's gonna be like, ah yes, the revolutionary and important seminal special effects from Xanadu. No. Right?
No. And I guess better movie scholars than us will know whether that was experimental or whether they were actually quite late to the party.
Sure.
But from the movies that I've watched, they weren't doing that.
I mean,
like that to me, like actually to me, Xanadu captures the 80s vibe.
Yes.
And so for that to happen in 1980,
yeah. Well, and part of it is, it's certainly, that sort of stuff hasn't existed in any movie musical we've seen. Like, even, like, Hair doesn't do that kind of stuff.
No, it does not.
You know, and that's maybe 2 years earlier, the movie. And, like, the mm-hmm. fact that they did make the choice of, like, you know, this, yes, they're going to dance, but they're going to dance and be outlined with blue electricity.
Yeah.
It's such a choice, such a...
It is.
And you wonder if it was a choice or just like, whatever. It'll look.
I know. But then if it was or whatever, I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
Go with it.
Yeah.
Because listen, everyone, it's bloody enjoyable.
It's worth one watch at least, just to say you've watched
it. It's worth at least one watch. Yeah. Yeah. I would completely agree. Okay. We've talked about the film enough. Let's talk about the actual show.
Hop on. I haven't said it for a while, but it'd be fun to say.
Yeah, okay. I'll let you.
I guess
we should be roller skating, shouldn't we?
We should roller skate. Oh, do they make motorized roller skates? That seems dangerous.
I feel like that must be a thing.
That must be. These days, with all the other motorized...
Although, how could you get... Oh, no, it would be motor... Yeah, okay. I was like, how could you get a combustible engine in a shoe? But it doesn't need to be.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
So, there was also a musical.
Which is, I had forgotten before we started doing research, this was one of the early library CD checkouts I did. Xanadu was in my iTunes, has been for decades. I just have never listened to it, save for maybe once or twice when I first got it.
Oh.
I think partially because it was...
yeah, because it was at that time.
Yeah, and it was so... I imagined it's because just the soundtrack is so inscrutable.
Yeah, for sure. You would be like, this isn't part of any musical.
This isn't part of any musical. I don't
know
what
it's... How did these pop songs get on here?
I don't know what it's referencing. The cover looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's... It's
just doing the cover for listeners.
It's for Jimmy has his hands over his eyes. It's a little.
I do.
I'm expecting the wind machine to start, so his hair flies back.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. yeah, it's not been on my radar.
No,
whatsoever. I think I knew Cheyenne was in it.
Yeah.
I think I knew. I must have known Carrie Butler was in it.
Sure.
I must have,
yeah.
Because this is early Carrie.
Yeah.
Because I knew she did Hairspray, which means I must have known she did this. Cause this was
I nice. Had no idea but Jackie Hoffman and Mary Testa were in it.
I had no idea that Jackie Hoffman and Mary Testa were in it at all.
And they are...
What a lovely surprise.
My favorite part of the show.
Okay, yeah, let's just talk about them straight off the bat. So, if you're, you know, watching along as you're listening to this show, you will find that the musical is very different in terms of story.
I would say, very, very different. In short, I described it to my boyfriend. I was like, they fixed it.
They did a fix.
They fixed it.
Yeah.
It makes more sense.
Story.
They made it a story.
You know, there was light and shade.
Yeah.
Now, hooray. Basically, Mary Testa and Jackie Hoffman... play effectively like the antagonists of the piece.
Yes, the evil muses. The big changes in the musical are we establish up front that, what's her face, Kira is a muse, is going to go to Earth, is going to try and help this art man.
Yes, and he did paint the mural.
And he did paint the mural.
That is in the musical.
Yes. And the other muses also maintain a presence throughout the thing. Yes, honestly, a Greek chorus.
Very much so.
You know.
Is it small casting? Is it a Greek chorus? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't
we
matter.
Don't care.
but two of the muses, I don't know. Isn't one of them Calliope?
I want you to say all of their names.
Calliope.
Calliope is the correct pronunciation. Well done. Have you practiced?
No. That one I know.
Okay.
The other one is Mel Begins something.
Melpony.
Melopony.
Melpomini.
Melpomini. Melanoma.
Yes, melanoma. It could be melanoma. Yeah, it's a Greek word.
The other ones don't matter.
Can you remember any of the other ones?
No.
Well, what's notable for the Greek fans amongst us, Jimmy, of course, being a huge one, in the film, she's Terpsichore, who is the muse of dance. Makes perfect sense.
Yes.
In this... she's Clio.
Oh.
And Terpsichore is just a different one. I'm like, why are you doing that? What's that change about? Why are you doing that? Nobody knows. Weird change. Remember we've talked about these before, like these weird intentional changes that they make.
And you're like, why this
why?
One? I want to know the story.
Yeah.
But so they made the plot have a more linear progression. The two sisters put a curse on Olivia Newton-John's character. So that she will fall in love with Sonny. And that's against Zeus's rules. And thus we have drama and stakes, finally.
That's it. Yes, there are finally some stakes. And the Danny character isn't as, like, lovely as Gene Kelly.
Yeah.
He takes a bit more convincing, but still comes round and still eventually
like helps
has a...
open the club.
Yeah.
Which is the theater this time. Because they keep referencing the theater that they're in.
Yeah, exactly. And it's more, Cheyenne talks about it being a like hub of all art forms, yeah, including athletics.
Interesting.
Which isn't an art form.
That's an...
I'm sure athletes amongst our listeners will say that, oh, it is absolutely an art form. It's not. It's sport.
It's not. They get more funding at my school.
Yeah, exactly.
But
bastard.
I think most importantly, the tone that...
I love that. They get too much funding to be art.
it's literally true.
It is literally
true. The biggest and most important change they made with the stage musical is that it knows what it is. There's a line I wrote down early on. I forget who says it, but someone has some quip about the show that they're doing right now. And they say, this is like children's theater for 40-year-old gay people.
Shockingly enough, it's Mary Tesla who says that. So Testa, not Tesla, very different person. in a way, like those two are, they have lots of these like self-referential comments. But actually, admittedly, it's kind of throughout the whole cast, because Carrie Butler has a fair few as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole. Doesn't Carrie Butler has a whole thing at the end that's like. Or when what's his face is Zeus and they're like, we shall adapt it into a better stage play from the inferior cinematic experience.
Yeah, basically. And also they keep referencing Clash of the Titans.
Yes, because the very end of the show is just Clash of the Titans.
It's just Clash of the Titans.
And at one point they lampshade that and Sonny's like, wait a minute, I've seen this movie.
It's so, and like to the point where Jackie Hoffman is impersonating Ursula Andress.
Yes.
Like, it's very peculiar. But it works.
It works. It works really well. There's plenty of roller skating. They put the audience on stage.
Carrie Butler's in skates the whole time.
Yeah.
Kudos.
Yeah. That's about the most spectacular thing it has going for it, in fact. It is a very, you can tell it's a very low budget endeavor.
V low budget. And also, like, an interesting, like, I feel like I've not thought about this enough, but is this the kind of, was it around this time that musicals did start to get quite stripped back, like, or certainly like certain presentation, because I'm thinking of like Next to Normal's just coming up.
Yeah,
Wedding Singer was pretty stripped back.
Yeah.
Spring Awakening,
I mean,
quite strict, you know what I mean?
I think we're certainly riding on, I think Xanadu is absolutely riding on the coattails of like the Jersey Boys revolution. And the realizing
that was quite high budget though.
It was high budget, but the set was definitely stripped back. And there is a sense that like you don't need to,
it doesn't need to be full.
You don't need to dazzle the audience. I think
Disney Castle.
I think the pendulum is swinging back from like the mega musical era.
Yeah.
You don't need a chandelier, you don't need a flying tire, like you can get away with just a couple, and certainly this has a couple tricks, but it's not, there are no big, you know.
No.
It's why there are people on the poster and not a thing on the poster.
Right, exactly. Like, it isn't winning awards for its set design.
Right, exactly.
At all. Very, very simple. But yeah, it's fine. It does the job. And I'd be interested to see, actually, if the cancelled tour did anything different with that.
Yeah, I wonder.
Because obviously, a big thing about tours in recent years is that they are a spectacle,
right?
And you bring your spectacle on the road. So I'd be interested to see if
I bet you would be it'd be the roller skating. They'd do more roller skating in the audience. They'd you know,
okay,
that would be my gamble.
Yeah,
you know, go Starlight Express with it and go all in on roller skates. Everyone's on roller skates as much as possible. All the muses are on roller skates all the time.
Yeah,
I bet that would be my,
because actually that's a good point, because even just in the script, there's not really much in the way of setting.
Right. No, there.
Like, you've got the office in the theater place.
You've got
and then I guess just generic Venice Beach.
Yeah. You've got the phone booth. And then you've got Mount Olympus.
Right. Yeah, okay, fair. So maybe it doesn't really need it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But I think they do, you know, more ramps, more tricks. That would be what I would do.
Go full Starlight Express.
Go full Starlight Express. Ramp up the camp. Write in. You know, do it like a Disney Parks theatrical show, where the genie is always out there, like, ribbing an audience member and making a joke about the Backstreet Boys and, like, whatever the pop culture reference you can make at the time. Like, that's what Xanadu the Stage Musical is. Don't get me wrong. I think it works.
Yeah.
But there's no, you know, it is certainly not a show with, like, deep integrity to uphold.
No, and so I think that's quite an interesting thing. Because any interview you see with the creators of this musical, they basically talk about how it's shit. Not the musical.
Uh-huh.
The source material.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They go on a lot about, like, wow, that was really bad.
Yeah.
Wow, this is really bad. And I find that odd.
Sure.
Not, I mean, obviously, it's tricky to defend a musical that is notoriously... people know it for being bad. It won 4 Razzies, for goodness sake.
Right. I believe it is the reason the Razzies
exist.
It
is the reason for the Razzies. Exactly. That isn't a good, you know, thing to start.
Right.
But I find it interesting that they lean into, this is really bad.
Yeah.
We're going to do it this way. Than the, this is a cult classic.
Right. Because that's a different angle. Yeah.
Because, yeah. Because I also feel like that's going to be where they're going to get a lot of their audience from.
Yeah.
Are the actual genuine fans of Xanadu.
Yeah, but I still think Xanadu has found this weird bit. Like, we went on end about how fun parts of it are to watch, still knowing it's completely terrible. You think of, like, the other cult classic that strikes in my mind is Rocky Horror, and the fans of Rocky Horror as a cult classic don't have that tail end that say, and also it's terrible. I don't think Rocky Horror is terrible, but...
See, I don't think... Because the thing about Rocky Horror is, it is a send-up.
Yeah, that's fair.
Whereas Xanadu was
in earnest.
Intentional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's...
That's fair. That's different. Yeah.
I also think, though, I think that... that's something that I think the musical struggles with.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it certainly appears to have struggled with, but in my opinion, is something that jars with me a little bit, is that because the film is so earnest and loving and happy and delightful, the musical it sometimes feels a bit like a bully.
Yeah, because when it takes its, like, sardonic tone about, like, doesn't What's-His-Face have a line about, like, you have until this afternoon to put this place together. That should be plenty of time for a musical comedy.
Right.
Like,
they pull all
sorts of those lines. I don't know if that one's exactly the right
one. And there's, like, you know, they make a couple of, like, allusions to the film, but very much at the film's expense.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like it's... Oh, we all know that this film is mad.
You can
mad as a box of
you frogs. Can picture it's... like the poor guy who showed up in his Xanadu shirt, who's like absolutely in love with Olivia Newton-John, and this is his favorite movie, and he shows up to this thing and is really disappointed by, like, how much they shit talk the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because it's that thing. It's like when you really like something, it's not fun when everyone shits on it all the time.
Right.
And you would think, oh, a safe space would be an adaptation.
Right.
And then the adaptation all kind of shits on it. Like, I think there's something there that I'm like, oh, that's a bit of a shame. And I think it really comes out in the cast recording.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I find quite weird is they keep a lot of the, like, stage direction choices.
Yeah.
I don't know the right word to describe this, but, like, vocal stage direction choices that make sense when you're seeing it.
Right.
But they keep a lot of them... In the cast
recording. Yeah.
And it makes it not enjoyable to listen to.
Yeah.
Because these songs are just they're just pop songs.
They have
songs.
Nothing to do with the action on stage.
Right. So if you were going to listen to these songs, you would listen to them as good arrangements of pop songs, right? But when you've got, for example, the phone box duet one.
Yeah.
Is that suddenly?
Yes, I think so. That's
sure.
Right.
And is it that one that she ends it? Or maybe is it Magic? I can't. There's one of them anyway. And Kerry Butler ends it like going like, or something like that. Right? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And it's a bit like, what's that?
Yeah.
Like, if you just listen to the Cash Grounder, which we know 90% of musical theater fans, that's how they find out about musicals.
Right.
You would be a bit like, what's going on? This, that doesn't sound good. Well, I was quite enjoying that song until then. Like,
and I do think they are. It's interesting that you bring this up, because I had this thought during the thing. They're stuck in like this catch 22 where the music has very little to do with the action that's going on. So mm-hmm. how do you make interesting vocal choices? And a lot of times they make very jokey vocal choices.
Yes.
That are very funny on stage, because that's the only thing to keep it interesting. Otherwise, you're just watching a concert, and that's not where we are.
Exactly. And because this is a parody of this show,
yeah.
they can't sing the songs in earnest. Like, the ballads can't be ballads
right.
without having a joke attached to it,
yeah.
Be it visual or otherwise.
Yeah.
And so in that vein, it's like, and we kind of come to our roadblock here, because it's like, so what's the point in having these songs?
Right. And the point in having these songs is that they're good songs and they're a pull and people expect them. But it.
And that's it, exactly.
And they do lampshade it, but they've struck the, like, the jukebox musical conundrum, right?
Totally. Now, again, interesting point. What they've done here, because they've introduced two new characters, these new characters need new songs.
Mm-hmm.
So they've gone from ELO's back catalogue mm-hmm. And pulled in Strange Magic and Evil Woman.
Yep.
Right? But great songs. And to be honest, if you were making this a jukebox musical for ELO,
yeah.
it works well enough.
In the musical are two of the more plot-driven songs.
Yeah, they're the kind of the songs that work.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And these are the songs that weren't in any way written for Xanadu,
yeah.
like the others were. So I think, like, again, that's a little bit more of a jar.
Yeah.
The one that they sing in Mount Olympus.
Have You Never Been Mellow?
Have You Never Been Mellow? Mm. Which is just an Olivia Newton-John
yep.
pop song,
yep.
right? Just a classic Olivia Newton-John ballad. The comedy of it there is it's sung by Zeus.
Yeah, and they
and everyone and it's like
they have to they have to write a whole scene just to get into the song. Like
yeah. So and again in that way I'm like, as a musical,
mm-hmm.
is this something we should be saying? Yeah, it's all a musical, or is it something else?
Yeah, and I do wonder if like and. Our art form is so small, it is difficult to justify splintering it even more.
Right.
Because you end up with full categories that are just one or two things, and that's not a category.
Precisely.
But it does seem like there is, and I wonder if this is my brain just justifying, you know, what we would deem more high art musical theater, not to be gatekeepy, but that's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
Versus the jukeboxy, toe-tappy kind of musicals.
The commercial breaks.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And like, but there is such a spectrum there too, because you get some, you know, everything from Jersey Boys to Mamma Mia to this, to All Shook Up. Like, these are all fit in that same category for me, but have such wild differences in how they go about bringing what I would consider musical theater traditions to the stage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I don't know. I just think this sits in a different place from every. It isn't like if we were doing Venn diagrams.
Yeah.
I don't know where I would put Xanadu.
Yeah, I would definitely.
Because it isn't. It's not a jukebox musical.
I think the addition of new songs would qualify it. That plus, hold on, I'll find the line. They lampshade it. It's a very funny joke. Kira says near the end. Then I shall take the improbably popular art forms in each moment of time. The stage adaptation of the inferior cinematic offering, the musical of the box that is juke. That's a joke. And I shall use them to remind mankind that there is something greater than wealth or fame, and that is the human experience rendered comprehensible through art. Which is a noble goal, and I think took a lot of thinking about to find a moral around this show.
Uh-huh.
And they did it. And the fact that they're lampshading the, you know, music of the box of juke, I think they think it's a jukebox musical.
Exactly. But I think that's weird because it's not.
Yeah.
Like, the only thing that puts it into that argument is that they include two songs from ELO's back catalogue and an Olivia Newton-John song.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only thing that would then make it a jukebox musical, but this is like a weird.
It is a weird
hybrid.
Well, it is almost like.
But also, because it's not. Uh-huh. I feel like we have had hybrids before,
sure.
Right? Of I can't think of any right now, I'm sure there will have been.
Technically, the original Chicago has kind of a semblance of being a hybrid jukebox musical. You lose it now in the contemporary productions because they've scrubbed this all off. But every number, save for Class, and it's weird that that's the only one,
right. Is
a direct intimidation impersonation of a popular vaudeville performer, nearly one-to-one.
Right, okay.
You lose that because, you know, how many popular vaudeville performers can you name these days? And it's been kind of scrubbed out of the subsequent adaptations. But it's the same sort of thing, right? There's a way to justify that as a jukebox musical of its time. It is a blending of pre-existing things. Certainly, Kander and Ebb wrote new stuff.
Uh-huh. But I think that's like it is still new. It's still new content.
Yeah.
It's not, you're not just pulling from the back catalog. Because like I feel like another one that comes into this bubble is like Saturday Night Fever.
Sure.
Which the musical is fully just an adaptation of the movie,
yep.
And the movie has a soundtrack by the Bee Gees, but it's for
right.
the movie. And in a similar way, the songs don't really...
Yeah.
They're not telling a story.
Yeah.
They create the world.
But is this endemic of adaptations of movie musicals from the late 70s, early 80s, right? Because, like, even, you know, Grease does it better, but only just.
It is better, though.
It is.
Because Hopelessly Devoted to You...
Yes.
Is fully a story song.
Is the spoiler, absolutely. But like...
Summer Lovin' is a... Come on.
Yeah, but...
Give Grease's credit.
Then Chang 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 Changity Bop. Like...
Yeah, it's a great finale. It's a lovely, broad... Here's the theme. Hooray, we're friends.
What I'm saying is there is this brand of movie musicals of this time where the music in the show need barely relate to the plot. And so that's part of the style. And that is... the underpinning of what a jukebox musical becomes. Like, you need just the spark of an inspiration to start singing a song, and then now all of a sudden we're in the middle of Super Trooper and Mamma Mia.
I guess. I don't know. I just... This isn't that, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not... It is its own... Like, these songs were written... for this purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, it's odd. But like you say, I think the writers think it's a jukebox musical.
Right. Well, and the songs.
And in some ways it is because like the cultness of the soundtrack surpassed the film that it became.
Right.
Almost like
its own standalone thing.
Its own cast record. Like.
Right. It's like learning that. You know, what if we, and who knows, this absolutely could happen, but we learn in 20 years that these 25 Lady Gaga songs actually all have a story that weaves through them that you never knew about before, and now here's the musical version of it, right?
I love that conspiracy theory.
I know, wouldn't that be great?
Can we talk about that?
Yeah. But it would be as if that Lady Gaga movie had existed previously and we all had forgotten about it because it was terrible.
Right, yeah.
And then needed a re-reminding.
But we can't even say that because the Sand Lady songs don't mean anything to each other.
I know. They're like, like the original is a jukebox musical in and of itself, in conceit at least, right? In how mismatched the music is to the action.
Yeah.
Which complicates things even more.
It does. It's just what a fascinating little cornerstone in our musical theater world.
Yeah.
Is Xanadu.
Yeah. When it is also we don't have the benefit of... There aren't a lot of movies that become cult classics because they're legitimately bad against their better intents, right?
Yeah.
You've got Xanadu, you've got The Room. You know, you have other, like, big Razzie winners, but none that have reached, like, cult classic status in that kind of way as much. Certainly none... Certainly none that are as much of a musical as the OG Xanadu was.
Yeah, because the one that weirdly popped into my head was like Newsies, but I guess it wasn't so much of a flop.
Right.
It's not like you can't put Newsies in the same bank as
right.
The Room.
It wasn't so bad that it's known
yeah.
for how bad it is.
Yeah.
Hold on, let me pull up Worst Picture Razzies. Other nominations, popular nominations, Early Annie, the Pirate Movie, which was the kind of recasting of Gilbert and Sullivan. I think we talked... Pirates of Penzance.
Pirates of Penzance.
I'm just scrolling through to see what other musicals there are. Not a lot. And I think some of these musicals are on here because they're musicals and people have bad opinions of musicals and they're judging it from a cinema lens, which is unfair.
Yeah. I mean, like Evil Dead.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, it's different.
Yeah. Oh, I guess Showgirls won in 95.
Showgirls isn't a musical.
Oh, you're right. I'm thinking of...
Dreamgirls?
Nope. Cher's in it.
Burlesque.
Burlesque.
That is a musical that didn't have a stage adaptation beforehand.
Yeah. But anyway, like...
Yeah. Yeah.
Such delightfully specific conditions to create Xanadu the musical.
Right. It's so... And it does feel like its own thing because, like, it's not so much of a parody that you feel like you're a Knight of Forbidden Broadway.
Right.
Right? But it's also not so much in earnest that you're watching the film Xanadu. Right. Like, there's so... It's a weird kind of power play between the two.
The thought I had was, like, if someone asked me before they saw the musical, like, do I need to watch the film? And I think it's one of the only ones where I don't quite know my answer. I think my answer would be, like, if you want to, I think it'll be a perfectly enjoyable night without having seen the film.
Fully.
But you'll get a little more if you have seen the film. But then you have to watch the film, which is an undertaking.
Right. But then because it's like, there's like, obviously there's lots of inside jokes and Easter eggs and things if you've watched the film and are a fan of the film. There's plenty in there for you. But I think just to kind of grasp the, like, why is this like weirdly tongue-in-cheek? And why is this, why does this feel like a parody?
Right.
And I don't think it is. Like that... I think that's what I'm trying to get at, is it feels like it is one, even though it's not, it's just an adaptation.
It does. I wrote it down because it felt so true. It feels like children's theater. It feels like a bunch of giddy adults who know what they're doing enough, but like also enjoy messing around. Or like, what if we just did Xanadu tomorrow and then just did it?
Right.
Like really well, but it has that energy of...
Yeah.
Not Mickey and Judy, let's put on a show, but like, we're going to reenact, last night's episode of Glee during lunch today because we're in middle school and that's how we pass the time.
It's got that kind of vibe. Yeah, you're right.
And
do you know what it has a kind of vibe of? It's pantomime.
Yeah. Especially with the audience on stage and a lot of, that kind of, gym office mugging to the audience of like this thing.
Yep. Yep, sometimes moments of audience interaction.
Yep.
Like Mary Testa's and Jackie Hoffman's characters are fully just they're two pantomime characters.
Always,
I mean? Like
they full out
evil, but they're not bad.
Evil, but not bad. I mean? You're you have no sympathy for them, but you are so delighted every time they're on stage.
Exactly, exactly.
And
like
I think a breaking down of, I had this thought. That is what makes pantomime audience participation different from other kind of audience interaction. Like, say, this is not Great Comet. You could look at the stage setup and think that it might be.
Right.
But there is a...
Not to put down Mimi Lean's incredible work.
Absolutely not. but there is, in panto and things like it... Not only is audience participation a part of it, the meta aspect of audience participation is also a part of the show. Like, not just that individual audience participation moments happen, but that there is the danger that they always could happen is a specific part of the show. I don't have the quite words to talk around what I think I'm trying to say.
I know what you mean. I do know what you mean.
Like, you should, in the same way that, like, scares my dad about Cirque du Soleil.
Right.
Like, there's gonna be audience participation. Get ready. Expect it. You could pull a joke in this show where, like, you get so close and then don't participate with the audience, and that would be funny.
Right.
And that's a part of it. Whereas, in other genres, audience participation becomes a fourth wall break, becomes a stepping out of the story. Whereas in Xanadu, it is so woven in that it wouldn't be the same show without audience participation.
Yeah. I think you're totally right there.
It's weird.
It's what a weird thing is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is that because the film is so weird?
I mean, I also think it's a weird time. You know, we're 2007 on Broadway. We're just kind of recovering from the dark times. We're just post-Wicked. You know, we're Broadway's kind of getting its feet again. Which gives it more room to experiment with weird stuff, while also we're seeing the new Wedding Singer Jersey Boys, you know, spat of popular adaptations and jukebox musicals.
Spam a lot.
And so, like, all of those factors together give you a perfect experimentation of, like, okay, we should find something popular to adapt, but also we can be confident enough that it can be a little out there. What do we pick? Probably Xanadu.
I feel you're all that matters. I rely on anything you say.
I'll take care, no illusion shatter. If you dare to say what you should say,
you make it seem not so close to my dream, and suddenly it's so there.
Suddenly. And I'm ready to sail any ocean. Suddenly, had I need the answers, 'cause I am ready to take all my chances with you.
So here's a question, right? Because, you know, always very fascinated with Broadway and the internet.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Right? Is it possible for Xanadu to happen and be successful now?
The movie or the musical?
The musical.
That's a good question.
As it is.
I don't think it would be as popular now.
I agree.
I think part of it would be we have a different set of expectations of Broadway right now.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
You know, I also don't think right now there doesn't seem to be a big wanting for even just fluffy pieces. The fluffiest we've gotten in recent years is kind of the Hello Dolly revival. And even that still ends with, like, a, you know, it only takes a moment and some romantic, like we still get a nice fluffy resolve, not like.
Yeah. And it's still, but it's still high Broadway. Do you know what I mean? In terms of spectacle.
Right. Exactly. Like, but, like, I don't think even, and this is not a great comparison either, but, like, we're not going to see A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum hit the stage either. Like, out and out, you know, that, like, farcical levels of humor. I'm trying to think of other shows that are that don't have a hint of sentimentality in them, in the way that Xanadu doesn't really have a hint of sentimentality. Like, do they fall in love at the end? Who cares? Like, we, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I guess you get the kind of Wedding Singer-esque stuff. But even that.
But even it does still have a bit of a, you know, I mean, you still care for that love story,
right?
And The Wedding Singer. I think the reason I asked the question is because so there was a lot of, like, internet stuff that went alongside this. I don't know if you've seen any of it.
Oh, yes. I have memories of it and not understanding it then and only vaguely understanding it now.
Exact same. Like, because I never watched the full thing because I guess in that time I didn't believe in episodic watching on YouTube. It was just like, this has John Gallagher Jr. in it, so I'm going to watch that.
Yeah.
And yeah, completely the same thing. And then coming back and then being like, wait, that was that thing.
Yeah.
So in the run-up to Tony's, they had this fictional child producer called Cubby Bernstein, who was basically like the surefire hit to get you a Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And he came and started working on Xanadu's Tony campaign. And it was publicity from Xanadu. Like, that is what it was.
It was publicity. It was viral marketing when viral marketing was new.
It's like Lonely Girl 15 style. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if this is real or I don't know if it's not.
Yeah.
Who's producing this? Because it was produced by this child.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was on his channel.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, on the Broadway.com official. Yeah. You know.
It's a very clever concept. I think looking back on it, I mean, it's wacky and wild, and Xanadu is the place where it deserved to happen.
Right.
You know, seeing the even lackluster success that all internet promotion seems to have for Broadway, stalwart Broadway audiences.
Yeah.
It seems terribly misguided for 2007. You know, maybe if it was better, it would have sold more tickets, but it's also not related to the show, so you don't get the satisfaction of the thing you watch online paying off when you go see the thing, because it's so wildly different.
See, that's interesting. I think it is really good. Like, I think it sells the show really well.
I think it's really good. I don't think anyone on YouTube was like, oh, gotta go buy my ticket now, you know? Like,
do you think?
Well, you're making me question that.
Because think of the other things. Again, this is one of the reasons I wanted to discuss this, was because, like, at that time,
yeah,
right, early YouTube days, yeah, right, before there was a Broadway.com
right,
scene,
yeah,
on YouTube, before there was a Broadway scene on YouTube, you know what I mean? This was pre-bootleg days. Yeah. Not pre-bootlegs, but pre-bootlegs on YouTube. Yeah. Like, it was a really interesting, because we had, like, the Spring Awakening vlogs. Mm-hmm. We had had, I'm trying to think what else was going on. Was Submissions Only at that time? That was later.
That was later. I mean, we're talking 12 years ago.
Yeah. But In the Heights had a little bit of, like,
yeah,
again, kind of vlog style presence.
Yeah, but we're so long before, you know, Ham for Ham,
right,
daily video vlogs of Lynn outside the
exactly,
stage,
like,
door.
Produced content,
yeah,
by a network, you know, Broadway.com. Like, it was, and it just felt very fringy. The one that I always think back on is the Spelling Bee video campaign.
I don't remember that one.
They did? You must remember this. It's the best. So it was Jesse Tyler Ferguson and the girl who played Logan.
Okay.
Made, like, vlogs of their own life,
oh,
fully improvised.
As in character.
In character. Yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah. And it gives me the same sort of vibe of, like,
yeah,
we're going to tell you about our show, but it kind of has nothing to do with the show.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, other world stuff. And I kind of love,
yeah,
that, because actually, in the same way, like, those improv things really fit what Spelling Bee is all about, because it's a very improv-heavy show,
yeah,
and it's wackadoo and stupid.
Yeah.
And it's a good look into these characters.
Yeah.
I feel like for Xanadu, it kind of works because it's this weird, like, tongue-in-cheek send-up,
yeah,
of a thing.
Do you know,
that isn't fully a parody, you know,
yeah,
that isn't fully a parody, but it's still sending up this idea.
This is the era we're in. You know what does predate Cubby Bernstein? The title of show.
Exactly.
And that's exactly the kind of theatrical, like, digital Broadway theatrical world we're in right then.
Yeah. Like, we're just about to get Side by Side by Susan Blackwell.
Yeah.
That's just on the horizon.
And I wonder if we're going to do, like, a micro unpacking of, you know, video viral marketing for musical theater online.
It's a good thesis.
Well,
because it mirrors the changes in,
yeah,
the internet itself. But at this point, it was still, like, a wild west.
We'd never have a Cubby Bernstein today, my God. Like,
no, not at all.
Which is a shame.
And it is a shame, because it's funny. It's good. It's good content.
Yeah.
Like, it's original
and
entertaining, but it's not, you know, clickbaity.
Yeah.
Celebrities to the front.
Yeah.
Like, all, you know, I mean, it was just
high, yeah,
concept.
And, like,
televised.
Love them to death, but you could take any nowadays Broadway.com, like, back, you know, whoever's on the show takes the camera and once a week gives you some bit of content about their show that's happening,
right?
You could put all of them side by side and you'll get the, like, oh, here's my dressing room, oh, look who came today,
yeah,
I sure you have always wondered how this works on stage, take,
yeah,
a look at this,
exactly,
cost, oh, we're taking photos, right? Like, same stuff all the time,
to the point where I've stopped
yeah,
watching them.
I don't care about that.
Do you know what,
yeah,
I mean? I can't remember the last one I kind of really, really tuned into.
Yeah.
But they did. They declined from being like, oh, this is cool, I'm seeing, you know, Ramin Karimloo's.
Right.
I don't know. to like, oh, you guys have really been wanting to see this person again, so we're going to do an interview with them.
Right.
Oh, you really, yeah, we'll do some Q&As. Oh, and it is, it's just all the same kind of like, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
You know. And it is fine for the fans who want, you know what I mean?
If you're really into the thing and you're really looking for all that content in there. But there's ways to do that that also can be creative, that aren't just like, here's my 10th vlog, putting on makeup.
Exactly. But it's like, I can't see anyone having that idea of like, we're going to do this scripted series alongside our show. Like, no one would have the time for that now.
Yeah, maybe we'll get there. I certainly think, you know, the viral nature of Beetlejuice has changed producers' hearts and minds. And then, you know, layer on top the Ratatousicle. I think it would be easier these days to convince the imagined, you know, old-timey producer folk that like, hey, digital content has an important place and it's going to get a little weird for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
I guess in a way, like the Beetlejuice TikToks have a similar kind of vibe because they are still very human.
Yeah.
They're not produced.
Yeah. And they're homegrown and that sort of thing. But that's the digital marker's poison, right? How do you make something that appears homegrown?
Yeah.
You're making it. So, so it's planned, right? It's impossible.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think there's so much, like, there's so many good things that could come out and I think would make me respect a show a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Because I actually think these little videos really contribute to my liking of the Xanadu musical, like the stage musical.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, like, respect.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
This is good.
Yeah. When I do wonder, I guess it becomes a, now I'm putting my, like, tech director hat on, it does become a partially philosophical question. Like, we've discussed the truism that like the moment you think that you want to go see the show is when the show begins, and anything that happens after that affects how you react to the show. We talked about this in Comet, of course, when with Mimi Lynn's great backstage walk onto the stage and the whole lobby entrance. But like that means poster design, that's commercial design, that's, you know, how easy Ticketmaster or whatever it is to use, like all of these things
for sure
are a part of the story that you're experiencing with the show. And I guess there are two philosophical sides to that. Should everything come from the heart of the show? Should everything be intrinsically tied to whatever your thesis message of the show is, right? From your poster design to, you know, your lobby design, or is it okay if some of those experiences are detached from the show, like Cubby Bernstein? Like, you know, some of the parody videos that Avenue Q made. Right. And I guess certainly it depends on the show. But I had never thought about it in that dichotomy before, that there's kind of a choice you have to make there, you know, in the way that marketing, you know, Book of Mormon, which is a show that absolutely could have gone more the Xanadu Avenue Q route, doesn't.
Totally.
You know, they have very strict, like, you'll never see a production photo of their Africa set, and that's on purpose.
Nope.
Like, that's their marketing is so strict with that show because they want to hide
some
of it. And they totally could have gone the opposite. And
like, yeah, you'd never see it with any of the Disney shows.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. I think you're onto something when you say in the internet world, would this be different? You know, maybe not about Xanadu, but I do think it is, like we talked about this in Wicked. It's harder to keep your show secrets these days. So maybe you should just abandon any desire to do so.
True.
Trust that people will be able to feel the thing of surprise in the moment because you did the art well, even if they knew what was going to happen coming in.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that is kind of what we've lost, isn't it?
Yeah. And for all sorts of reasons, not just the internet, but that the art form is more popular and more widespread, and there's been a narrowing of what is popular. Like, everyone knows the chandelier is going to fall in Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in part, like, I'm sure the first time that happened, it was amazing and startling, and, you know, it's not anymore. You know, and like this all backfired with Spider-Man, that they were trying to keep all these effects secret, but then people kept getting hurting, and then people kept getting more curious about the whole thing. You know, I think this all I don't know the thesis that ties all these thoughts together, but there's something there.
They're all bound together. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, either way, freaking Xanadu, mate.
Good old time. I was not expecting the stage musical to be as enjoyable as it was.
Yeah. I'm going to say it, though. Mm-hmm. I still prefer the film.
Oh, man.
Just saying.
That's nuts.
Oh, I just want to manifest something. Yeah. Because it hasn't manifested itself since the last time. Mm-hmm. So, come on. This is Kenny Ortega and Douglas Carter-Bean.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We know that they can work together on stage musicals. Yeah. Hurry up with Tu Wong Fu. Hurry up. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Xanadu Live.
There we go.
Xanadu Live Television.
No.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. No, too small.
Be cheap.
It would be very cheap. No.
Get some...
No. Because this... No, it wouldn't work. The songs aren't good enough. As musical theater songs.
Yeah.
Right? Because those live musicals, right, need to have, like, songs.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like... the tunes.
Where you can zoom in on the face and, yeah.
They're not going to be all about, like, magic.
Yeah, that's fair.
The book?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the full thing itself, no. And that's why it doesn't work.
Yeah, no, you're fair. Okay, let me pitch you this. The Room, the musical on stage.
Why hasn't that happened yet? I mean, like, we know for a fact there is someone in, like, Wisconsin who's written Zoom the Musical.
Yeah.
Zoom. you know what I mean? Like, for sure that exists somewhere as a weird YouTube parody kind of thing. But also, why hasn't that?
I know. Because I was running through, like, what are, you know, those bad movies? Like, what are, you know, what are we going to song spot? What are we going to find?
Yeah. But first, 213, thanks for everything, Julie Newmar. And then, through the room.
You hear that, Kenny Ortega?
Tommy, they call it Xanadu.
Xanadu! I do, every club I walk into from now on, especially once the bad times are over, I want to be greeted by Gene Kelly on roller skates, turning around, smiling, and gesturing to the title of the club.
He was so good on those
roller
skates.
He was so good on roller skates. I'm not surprised.
He's an older man. Yeah. What a man. Anyway, enough about him, enough about that. Tommy, what's next?
I have a quiz question. Buckle your seatbelt.
Please tell.
It's going to be a bumpy night. It was a complete accident that this musical and a film with the exact same name and premise premiered during the same year. What show?
I don't know, but if you would like to get in touch with us, you absolutely can and should. Our Twitter and Instagram are both at JIMANDTOMIC. That is Jim and Tomic. Or you can drop us an email if you'd like to go long form on our website, jimandtomic.com.
We also have merch and a Discord. If you head over to the show notes, you can find the invite for the Discord and the links for the merch on our website. If you're heading for the Discord link, get there right now because it expires soon. But don't worry, there's always more.
There will always be more. Yes, and while you're on our website, if you would like to financially support the show, that'd be very lovely. We have a Patreon there that you can check out, that also hosts our video podcast that we call Last Call, where we have some good old-fashioned fun. This time we bitch about a certain unnamed YouTuber.
And talk about trash bags, both very...
And talk about compost.
But most of all, it really helps when you tell your friends about our show. Thank you for all of you who tell other people about our weird, wacky musical theater podcast.
Yeah. It's very, very nice. And hey, thank you very much for listening. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.